I put my arms around his waist. Listen, it's not as if she was there to critique it. Just let it go. It was fine. He opens his mouth to respond, but we are interrupted by an elderly couple coming to say their goodbyes. At the same time, Harriet comes to tell me that Edie wet her pants and Aunt Nettie wants to know if she has spare undies. I'll deal with the undies, I say to Ollie. I follow Harriet through the throng, turning sideways to squeeze past people. Harriet and I come to a clearing on the outside deck where Edie stands, naked apart from a pair of gold sandals. Tipsy adults smile. Sweet. Nettie squats next to her, drying her legs with a wad of paper towels. There's something so maternal about it, it stops me short. I have to remind myself that Edie is my daughter, that I'm her mother. A chink of spoon against glass steals everyone's attention, and when I turn around, I see Ollie is standing on a chair. I leave Edie with Nettie and charge back inside. What on earth?
Can I have everyone's attention, please?
He is saying as I slip back inside. A hush goes around the room, and I feel my insides squeeze tight. Ollie isn't the type to give impromptu speeches. He is a planner, a practicer, a reader of index cards. I glance around for support, but there is only Nettie, who is still outside dealing with Edie. Patrick is over by the bar.
Sorry to steal you away from your drinks and conversations, he starts. I just feel that I didn't quite say everything I wanted to about Mum today.
One by one, people whisper hushed endings to their conversations and give Ollie their full attention. I grab a glass of champagne from a circling waiter and throw it back.
The fact is, Mum wasn't the warmest and fuzziest person in the world. Actually, she was a pretty hard taskmaster. If there was ever a spider or a rodent to kill, guess who we went to? I'll give you a hint, it wasn't Dad.
A gentle chorus of laughter rings through the room. It reassures me a little.
As kids, whenever we sat down, Mum would always hand us a bag of baby clothes that had been donated and make us sort them into sizes. We'd complain, usually, and she'd tell us that she'd be happier to take away our clothes and make us accept donations from clothing houses and then see if that changed our tune on helping.
At this, Ollie's voice starts to wobble.
I remember folding up a tiny white knitted jacket once and putting it on the top of a pile of newborn clothes. Mum noticed it and yanked it out of the pile, saying it was stained. I told her they'd probably still accept it, and she said, "It's not my job to give them what they would accept."
Ollie does a pitch-perfect Diana impression.
"It's my job to give them what they deserve."
He glances at me, and I nod. Perfect.
Mum could be difficult, but that was part of what made her great. And that's what made her a lifeline to some people. Come on, give me a break.
The voice coming from the back of the room over by the bar is booming and unapologetic. Heads whip around. It isn't hard to find Patrick, a full head and shoulders above the crowd.
Diana wasn't a lifeline, he says. She was a life sucker.
Ollie looks startled. Like most people, he'd been so caught up in his lovely tribute he hadn't seen it coming. I too am startled. The crowd shifts to look at Patrick. I start toward him, but the room is full, and it is like walking through sludge.
If we're honest, we'll admit that no one is upset that she's dead. We've just come for the free food and booze. And why not?
Patrick spots me charging toward him through the crowd.
Save yourself the trouble, Lucy. I'm done.
He raises his glass.
To Diana. May she rot quickly.
He tips his glass to his mouth and swallows the drink in one mouthful. I glance around for Nettie and find her standing in the corner of the room. A single tear runs down her cheek. Chapter 38. Lucy. The past. I snap a photo of Harriet, asleep in her hospital cot. The morning light dapples on her, and I feel hyper aware of the preciousness of it,
If things had gone differently a few days ago, she may not be here, and I don't take this second chance for granted.
How is our little angel? Ingrid asks from the doorway.
Ingrid has been the primary nurse tending to Harriet. A grandmother, she'd proudly told me a few days ago, to a little boy named Felix, who was about Harriet's age. It is perhaps the reason she'd gone above and beyond for us, even picking me up a latte from her local coffee store on the way in after hearing me tell Ollie I couldn't stand the hospital coffee. Then again, Ingrid seems the type to go above and beyond with everyone. I put my phone down on the side. She's fine, sleeping.
Do you want me to get a photo of the two of you?
I think about that for a second. Actually, I would love that. I scooch up beside my sleeping daughter and place my head next to hers while Ingrid snaps a picture. The picture is filled with chins and you can see right up my nose, and I will cherish it forever.
Your mother-in-law phoned a moment ago,
Ingrid says lightly. Diana has phoned every day, twice a day. When I didn't answer my cell, she started calling the hospital and checking in with the nurse's station. She knows Harriet is going to be okay. I made Ollie text her as soon as we knew. I'm still angry with her, but no one deserves to worry about a child for a second longer than they have to. I feel Ingrid's eyes on me, and I sigh. Ingrid knows, of course, what I did to Diana. Everyone in the entire hospital knows about the assault. That's what the nurse who had discovered us had called it, an assault. It actually is probably an accurate description of it, though Diana had been quick to refute it, insisting, even after she was taken to emergency on a stretcher, that it was all a private family matter. I had to hand it to her. Diana Goodwin would go to any lengths to avoid making a scene.
You're a bit of a hero around here, you know,
Ingrid says, opening Harriet's chart.
Everyone's wanted to give their mother-in-law a head injury at least once in their life.
Even you, Ingrid.
Especially me, and my daughter-in-law wants to give me one occasionally, I'm sure of it.
I doubt that, I say. If I had a mother-in-law like you, Ingrid, I'd be over the moon.
Ah, oh, you think that now? She smiles. But I'd get on your nerves after a while. Everyone given enough time will get on your nerves if they join your family.
Why is it that mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law always seem to have issues and never sons-in-law and fathers-in-law? Ingrid scribbles something on the chart.
Sons-in-law and fathers-in-law don't care enough to have issues.
So we have issues because we care? I ask.
We have issues because we care too much.
Ingrid glances at her watch, then makes another note on her chart. Then she replaces the chart on the end of Harriet's cot. She's in the doorway, about to leave, when she pauses.
Your mother-in-law has been calling a lot, you know.
She loves her granddaughter, I say. I'll give her that.
Perhaps, Ingrid says. But you should know that each time I've answered the phone when she's called, the first person she's asked about is you.
When Ollie arrives at the hospital half an hour later, I tell him I have to go. He doesn't ask where, and I'm sure he assumes I want to go home and shower or change my clothes or get something for Harriet. We have been tag-teaming in this way for a week. I let him assume that. As I drive, I am thinking about what Ingrid said. We care too much. I wonder if it's true. If I didn't care, I could go on with my own life, accepting the mother-in-law I have, like Patrick has. He doesn't like Diana particularly, but unless she had done something to irritate him in that particular moment, he is positively undisturbed by this dislike. He doesn't pretend to get along with her or get upset about it. It doesn't seem to affect him at all. And so, I'm going to forgive Diana. Not because I like her or because I think what she did was forgivable. I'm going to forgive her to release myself. I'm going to give up caring so much.
I pull up in front of Tom and Diana's house, behind Tom's car, which is parked in the front, unusual for a workday. I ring the bell, but no one comes. After a while, I press it again. It takes a long time for Diana to come to the door, but finally I see her through the glass door. "Lucy," she says. I blink. It might be the first time I've seen Diana without any makeup. Her hair is wet and combed straight back over her small oval head, and her entire face, skin, eyelashes, lips, appear to be the same wishy-washy beige color. She puts a hand to her chest. "Oh no, is it Harriet?" "No, no," I say quickly. "Harriet's fine." But Diana is shaking, all of her trembling. I reach out and steady her. "Diana, Harriet is fine," I say again. But she continues to shake. I grasp her shoulder and bring her into the house. Something isn't right. She stares at me, her eyes wide and vulnerable. I take her other shoulder, about to ask her what's wrong, when her knees give way. I catch her and lower her to the floor. "Tom," I call. "Tom, are you here?" "I'm sorry," she says, starting to sob. "I'm sorry, Lucy. It's Tom. It's my darling Tom." "Tom has MND, Diana says. "Motor neuron disease. It's..." "I know what it is," I say. I remember the ice bucket challenges a few years back, people dumping ice water over their heads to raise money and awareness for it. Clearly it was successful, as before that I'd never heard of it. "Tom has suspected something wasn't right for a while, but he kept it to himself. It's all crystal clear in hindsight. His muscle cramps, weakness. His handwriting is worse than Archie's. His drooling." A tear slides down her cheek, but other than that, she's regained her composure. "I always found it so adorable when he drooled. Little did we know." Diana and I are sitting in the good room. Diana holds a cushion in her lap and fiddles with the little bits of gold thread that are woven through. "The MND won't affect his intellect, but it will strip him away from his physicality until he is no longer able to express his intellect. Until people are speaking to him like he's a child and he's powerless to tell him that he's not deaf." Another tear slips down her cheek. "But I'm not going to let them do that. No one will speak to him like he's an imbecile. He will have me." Diana brushes the tear off her cheek and gives a little nod, as if this fact pleases her. And likely it does. She may not have any control over Tom's illness, but she has control over how he is treated, and she's going to make sure he's treated well. For all of her foibles, Diana is someone you want on your side. Perhaps that's the problem. I've never felt like she has been. "What can I do?" I ask. Diana gives a hopeless little shrug, the saddest shrug I've ever seen. She blinks slowly, hugging the cushion in her lap to her body. She looks so fragile, I want to grab a throw rug and wrap it around her shoulders. I've never wanted to do this to Diana before. "Diana," I start, as my phone begins to ring. It's Ollie. "Sorry, I'd better get this. It might be about Harriet."
"Don't tell him, Lucy. Please don't tell him."
Diana looks at me, and it's as though her soul has returned to her body. The sharpness has returned to her eyes. She's on. It makes me feel sad and also strangely privileged that she let her guard down with me, even just for a few seconds. "Okay," I say. She turns her head away as if to give us some privacy.
"Harriet's awake," Ollie
says. I hear her babbling in the background, and maybe it's the news of Tom's illness, but my need to have my daughter in my arms is so fierce it takes my breath away.
"I thought you'd want to come."
"I do," I say. "I do want to come. I'll be right there."
"Thank you,"
Diana says as I put the phone in my purse. Tom really wants to be the one to tell the kids. It's funny hearing her call Ollie and Nettie kids, but then perhaps that's how a mother always thinks of her offspring. I wonder if, perhaps, that's at the root of all our problems. I sit in Diana and Tom's good room, but this time I'm in on the secret. Nettie and Patrick sit side by side on the overstuffed couch, upright, at attention. Ollie and I sit in the armchairs facing each other. Diana and Tom sit side by side opposite Patrick and Nettie. "Can I get anyone a drink?" Diana asks, and we all shake our heads, eager to get to the point of tonight's family meeting. We haven't had a family meeting before, and I know Ollie assumes it's about what happened to Harriet. I haven't been able to tell them otherwise without admitting what Diana told me about Tom, and I don't want to do that. For one thing, I think it's Tom's right to tell his children this. For another, it's the first time I've had Diana's confidence, and I'm determined to prove that I can keep it. I watch Tom in the armchair, looking for symptoms of his MND. As far as I can see, he is healthy. As for his gentle slur, it's something I've become fond of, and always attributed to the fact that he is usually on the scale between tipsy and drunk. "All right, I won't mince words," he says. "We all know I'm here to tell you something, and you're probably feeling like it's something bad, which I'm sorry to say it is. I've been diagnosed with motor neuron disease, which you probably heard of. It's the disease everyone was doing that ice bucket challenge nonsense for a few years back. It's otherwise known as ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. Anyway, it's a degenerative disease affecting the nerves in the brain and spinal cord that tell your muscles what to do. Eventually, the disease will progress to the point that my muscles will weaken, stiffen, and waste. I won't walk or talk properly, I won't be able to eat or drink very well, even breathing will be difficult." Tom speaks quickly and he sounds mildly irritated, but I know it's just because he feels so off-kilter. He's always the one in the family that smooths things over, makes problems go away. It would be killing him to be the one creating problems this time. "Anyway, it is what it is, and I'll make the best of it," he says. And then he doesn't say anything. Nettie's and Ollie's reactions surprise me in that they have precisely no reaction at all. No movement, no sharp intake of breath, just a rhythmic blink, a second or two out of sequence. Patrick brings a hand to his mouth, rests his chin on his thumb. "Will you die?" Nettie asks finally.
"I will die, yes. As will you, your brother, your mother, Lucy and Patrick. All of us will die. But I will likely be the first one to go, probably in the next 5 years, maybe even in the next year."
Diana reaches for Tom's hand.
"No one lives forever," Tom says, "so I like to make the next year count. For me, that means lots of time with family, my wife, my children and their spouses."
His gaze finds mine.
"And my grandchildren, if you'll allow it, Lucy. I am responsible for what happened to Harriet. If she hadn't recovered, I'd never have forgiven myself."
"Of course you can see the kids, Tom, as much as you'd like."
"Dad, I..."
Ollie sits forward. He appears to wrestle with something, but finally continues.
"I know this is early days, but you'll want to get your affairs in order. Your power of attorney, your medical instructions. You'll want to look at succession planning for the business and a sale to a partner if you want to go that way."
Idly, I wonder how Ollie knows this. It rolls off the tongue, as though he were a wills and estates lawyer rather than a recruiter. Then suddenly he looks awkward.
"Also, you'll want to make sure your will is up to date."
"Oh, I think it is too early to start discussing that, hun," I say.
"Everything is in order," Tom says.
Ollie nods.
"Can I ask what it states?"
"Ollie!"
Diana and I exclaim together. I understand that bad news can bring about unusual emotions,
but Ollie is being extraordinarily insensitive.
There's no secrets to be had here, Tom says. In the event of my death, everything goes to Diana. If we both go at once, everything goes to you kids and your partners, an even split.
I glance at Ollie. He seems appeased.
You never expect to have to discuss these things with your family, Tom continues. Deep down, we all think we're going to live forever. This is, I'll admit, a bit of a rude awakening.
Tom tries for a laugh, but his voice cracks. Oh, Dad. Ollie goes to Tom's side and puts his arms around him.
I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry.
Tom leans into Ollie and his eyes close briefly. It's a beautiful moment. I only wish it had happened before they'd discussed the contents of the will. Chapter 39 Lucy The Present. It's strange being back at Tom and Diana's. Gerard gave us strict instructions that we were not permitted to remove anything other than sentimental items, but Nettie and Patrick were here yesterday, and things have vanished since then. A vase that had been on display in the main room, for one thing. I can't really say I blame them. With the financial hardship we are in, I could be tempted to pick up a vase or two myself. I'm relieved, though, that Ollie hasn't suggested it. His behaviour has been so strange lately. I'm glad to see he is still the man of integrity that I married. In the library, I watch him open a photo album, flick a few pages, then put it down again without looking at it. We don't have to do this all today, you know.
We have to do it sometime, he says. Might as well be now.
I take him by the hand and walk him over to the couch and sit beside him. Ollie, talk to me. He closes his eyes, massaging his forehead with thumb and forefinger.
It's just being here in this house. It's weird, right? I can't believe she is gone.
I can't either. He opens his eyes, stares right ahead.
I have no parents. That shouldn't freak me out in my mid-40s, but it does. On top of that, my sister doesn't want anything to do with me.
He blinks several times, as if processing this.
You're all I've got, Luce. You and the kids.
We're not going anywhere, I tell him. He looks at me, nods slowly. I try to picture what our life will be like now. Our new life, now that we are financially ruined. I'll have to get a job. The big kids will have to go to before and after school care, and Edie will have to go to full-time daycare. It will be different, that's for sure. But we're not going anywhere. Ollie looks at me.
You look different lately. Your clothes aren't so wild.
I look down at my black jeans, grey t-shirt and nude ballet flats. The shirt has a bedazzled picture of the Eiffel Tower on the front, but it's a relatively plain outfit by my standards. I don't even have any hair accessories or adornments in. The only jewellery I'm wearing, in fact, is the necklace Diana left to me. My style is evolving, I admit. Ollie smiles.
This outfit actually reminds me of something Mum would wear.
I smile back. I don't tell him Diana didn't own a pair of jeans, and she would roll over in her grave if she heard anyone suggest that she might wear a bedazzled t-shirt. His point, that I'm favouring plainer, more practical outfits lately, is a valid one. Odd as it sounds, Diana might have played a role in that. We go through a few more items before we decide to call it a day. Then, as we are about to get into the car, I hear gravel crunching on the driveway.
Lucy! Ollie!
We turn in unison. Ahmed and Jones are coming down the driveway toward us. Immediately I go on high alert. Hello, I say uncertainly. They continue walking toward us. They're not alone. Beside Ahmed is a woman in workout gear whose face is far from friendly. She plants her feet, several meters back from us.
It was him, she says quietly to Ahmed. Him, definitely.
Ahmed remains beside the woman, and Jones continues a few paces farther up the driveway, stopping in front of us.
Can we help you? Ollie says.
We've just been talking with the neighbours again, Jones says, trying to ascertain who was the last person to see your mother before she died.
She glances back over her shoulder at the woman in the activewear, the woman who is looking at Ollie, but slightly south of his face, as though she's nervous to look him in the eye. Nervous to look at Ollie.
It was him,
the woman says again, louder now.
What was him? I ask her. I live across the road, she says.
She seems happy enough to look me in the face.
I was headed out for a run last week, the same day Diana was killed, and I saw him.
She jabs a thumb at Ollie.
Walk through the gates.
Were you here, Ollie? Jones asks. The afternoon your mother was killed?
Ollie shakes his head, baffled looking.
No.
You were wearing navy trousers and a checked shirt.
The woman nods deeply, as if becoming more convinced herself.
Blue and white.
You must be getting him mixed up with someone else, I say. Or maybe you saw Ollie here another day? Both are reasonable explanations. Besides, Ollie's not particularly distinctive looking. Tall, medium build, brown hair. It would be easy to discount this woman's account of things, and that's exactly what I do. Until a memory flashes into my mind. It's Ollie, arriving home from work the day Diana died. He's wearing navy trousers and a blue and white checked shirt.
Chapter 40. Lucy. The past.
Shh, I say to the kids as we enter Diana and Tom's house. Of course, it doesn't make the blindest bit of difference. It's impossible to silence kids' plastic shoes against marble, and Archie and Harriet scamper loudly through the place, feet slapping as they go. We let ourselves into the house these days. I get the feeling Diana isn't delighted about this, but her life is about practical matters now that she is caring for Tom around the clock, and it's not practical for her to be answering the door all the time. I follow the kids, hauling baby Edie in her car seat through the main floor. Everything has been moved onto this level since Tom has been in his wheelchair. I like the house more like this, actually. With the extra furniture down here, the house is filled out nicely and has a cozy feel it didn't have before. Also, everything is closer together. You can call out and pretty much anyone in the house can hear you.
It's us,
I say as we enter the back room. Tom's wheelchair is pushed up to the table. Diana is beside him, reading the newspaper aloud, but she pauses to hug Archie and Harriet, who throw themselves at her with abandon.
Give Papa a hug, she instructs them.
They look at her uncertainly and she nods. Go on. They're a little frightened of him now. His hands are gnarled and his head is bent. He can be difficult to understand, but he is determined to keep talking. I think this is wonderful, but the kids get frustrated by it, or lose interest, or worse, say something rude.
Papa's spitting, Harriet will say,
or,
why is Papa's head like that?
Papa can hear you,
I say in a false jovial voice. But Diana doesn't gloss over it like I do. A couple of weeks ago, she asked Archie and Harriet to imagine how frustrating it would be to want to say something to people when no one would listen. Archie came to me a few minutes later and told me he would always listen to Papa, and to his credit, he's been very patient ever since. Harriet hasn't been quite so empathetic, telling me she doesn't understand why he wouldn't just watch TV and not bother talking to anyone. I vacillate between accepting that she's just a child and feeling responsible for the fact that one day Harriet will be out there in the world inflicting herself on anyone who'll listen. It won't be long now. Tom has been in and out of the hospital for months, with upper respiratory tract infections, breathing difficulties, pain and discomfort. Diana is constantly in motion, feeding Tom, shifting him in his seat, giving him medication. She phones doctors and nurses, gives instructions, makes arrangements. It's as though she's become an extension of him. He just has to look at her, and she's out of her chair, tending to him. Tom's illness has put a temporary halt on the family issues. We've all been working well together as a team, taking him to appointments, dropping off meals, driving across town to pick up various pieces of equipment designed to make him a little more comfortable. But everyone is broken-hearted. I am broken-hearted. I can't fathom this family without him. I watch Diana, intermittently wiping the corners of his mouth. She says something to him, and his eyes crinkle up and his lips twist, and I know he's trying to smile. The rest of us will be broken-hearted after Tom dies, but it will be worse for Diana. I'm not sure what will happen to her. I don't know how she'll go on. Chapter 41. Lucy. The present.
Is Ollie under arrest? Nettie asks me.
She's on my living room floor surrounded by Legos while Patrick engages the kids in an epic game of tag that involves pools of lava and cushions you have to stand on to stop your feet from getting burned. When the lady in activewear identified Ollie as being at Diana's house the day she died, and Jones said she wanted to talk to Ollie back at headquarters, I called Nettie to see if she could help with the kids. I never would have asked her a favor for myself, but I knew Nettie would be there for the kids, and I certainly needed her help.
No, he's just answering some questions. He'll be back in a little while.
But in fact, I have no idea if this is true. Ollie wasn't under arrest when he left with Jones and Ahmed, but for all I know, he is now. And I don't know if he'll be back in 5 minutes or 5 years. The only thing I do know is that he was wearing a blue and white checked shirt the day Diana died, and that he came home from work early even though he wasn't unwell. Now, I'm wondering why. Nettie's face is drawn and worried. Nettie is the younger sister, younger by 6 years, but she has always seemed older. And despite our issues, I know she loves her brother.
Are you okay?
I ask her, and her eyes immediately begin to well. I sweep the Legos to the side and kneel on the floor beside her.
I'm sorry.
She produces a tissue from her shirt sleeve and dabs at her eyes.
I don't know what's wrong with me. There's just a lot going on.
I hover awkwardly beside her. Once I would have hugged Nettie, but as we are no longer in that place, I place a reassuring hand on her shoulder instead. I'm caught off guard when she throws her arms around my neck in response.
Shh, I say. It's all right.
But it's not all right. None of it is. My heart bleeds for Nettie. Even without everything else going on, I still remember the rawness of losing my mother like it was yesterday. It occurs to me that Nettie and I have this in common now. She is older than I was when Mum died, obviously, but I doubt there is a loss in the universe more profound than a daughter losing her mother.
Sorry, Nettie says, sitting back and wiping her face. Please, don't apologize. It's just being here, the kids, the toys. It's just hard, you know? It just reminds me of what I'm not going to have.
What you're not going to...
It takes me a moment to understand. She's not upset about her mother. She's not even upset about Ollie. She's upset about her fertility. I shift away from her.
I thought you were upset about your mother, about Ollie being called in for questioning.
Oh, everyone's being called in.
Nettie waves her hand dismissively.
It's no big deal.
No big deal? Didn't the police tell you about the cushion? Didn't they tell you they think someone might have smothered Diana?
Nettie starts picking up Legos, putting them into the basket absently.
At the stage of life I'm in,
she says, her voice cracking. I thought there'd be Legos all over my floor. Scribble on the walls. I thought I'd be spending my weekends at school carnivals and ballet lessons. You have everything I want, Lucy.
I look at her. Really look. Physically, she's right in front of me, but emotionally, she is somewhere else. It occurs to me that she's been somewhere else for a while.
I really thought you'd help me, she says,
then dissolves into tears.
Nettie!
I sense movement in the corner of the room and Patrick steps forward. Something gives me the idea that he's been standing there for a while.
I think I should take Nettie home, he says.
Patrick gathers up Nettie's bag and her coat, and for the first time I wonder how it must be for him, living with Nettie's baby obsession. That kind of thing had to take its toll on a person.
Why don't you both stay here a while? I say. I could make some tea?
Nettie gets to her feet, her gaze miles away.
Patrick's right, she says robotically. We should go.
Chapter 42. Lucy. The past.
Head on inside, I say. There are refreshments in the back room. I stand at the grand double doors of Tom and Diana's home, ferrying mourners inside in small groups. Tom's funeral was at St. Joan of Arc, the church on the corner, so most of the guests decided to walk down to the house, even some of the elderly ones. The day is crisp and bright, with beating sunshine that everyone suggests is Tom's doing, and maybe it is. If there is an afterlife, Ollie had said in his eulogy, Tom would have certainly made an entrance, demanding the best of everything, including the sunshine. Tom had died the previous Friday of an upper respiratory infection. He'd wanted to be at home, and Diana had fought hard for him to have his wish, but in the end they'd both had to accept that it wasn't to be. His disease had progressed quickly, faster than anyone expected, and for the last few months he'd been unable to breathe unassisted or do anything for himself. Thankfully, he had Diana to do it all for him. Edie has been on Nettie's hip most of the day, and the older kids tear around the house as though it's a birthday party rather than a wake. Even Archie, who'd been quite overcome with emotion in the church, seems more relaxed now. He's removed his tie, which he'd wanted to wear and borrowed from Ollie, and now he's chasing Harriet between the legs of the guests. Archie! I shout whisper. Why don't you go play upstairs? You can even turn on the television if you'd like.
Within seconds, both of them are gone. Inside the house, waiters circulate with platters of food. Along one wall, a long table had been set up with sandwiches and soft drinks, cakes and wine. Somehow, Diana has managed to get the details exactly right, so it is welcoming but not festive, somber but not depressing. Tom would have been so pleased. My role, as handed to me by Diana, is to welcome guests as they arrive. There's not a lot to it. People come in talking about how it was a lovely service and they say they're sorry. I welcome them and point out where they can find themselves a drink and a chicken sandwich. A year ago, I'd have assumed that Diana had given me this role to keep me out of her hair, or because I wasn't capable of much more. But today, knowing she specifically gave me this post, I feel a strong sense of commitment to it. From my post at the door, I catch glimpses of Diana every so often, standing on the edges of circles accepting people's condolences. She does so with the utmost composure and grace. Diana managed the funeral details single-handedly, with the exception of the eulogy, which she had delegated to Ollie and he'd done a wonderful job of it. I'd looked over at Diana during the funeral and found her sitting very still, and I had a sudden urge to slide over to her in my pew, perhaps place a hand over hers. Now I regret that I didn't. Come in, I say, as a new gaggle of mourners step through the gate. I take the arm of a woman who must be in her 90s and support her weight as she climbs the 3 steps to the house.
She smiles at me and says, "Thank you, dear." It makes me think of my mother. "Lucy, dear, dinner's ready." It had been a long time since someone called me dear. I'd forgotten how nice it felt to be dear to someone.
"Excuse me, ma'am."
When I turn, a waiter in a grey jacket is standing before me.
"I can't seem to find Mrs. Goodwin."
I glance around. The room has filled. The hum of chatter has risen and there are small plates of half-eaten canapés on tables and mantels. Diana is nowhere to be seen.
"Oh, well, what is it you need?" "I'd like to check if we should start serving coffee and tea."
"I don't see why not." I glance at the front path and decide it's safe to leave my station.
"I'll see if I can find Diana."
I search the ground floor of the house. I find Nettie on the back patio, Edie still clamped to her hip.
"Lucy, where is the diaper bag? Edie is ready for a nap and I need to find her pacifier and her lammy."
"It's in the bedroom at the top of the stairs. The porta cot is already set up in there. Have you seen your mum?" Nettie shakes her head.
"But Uncle Dave is looking for her. He and Auntie Rose are leaving. They want to say goodbye."
Nettie takes Edie up the stairs, and I keep pushing through the crowd, scanning the faces. Ollie is in the front room listening to his cousin Pete reenact a story that appears to involve a donkey.
"Lucy," he calls out. "Where's Mum? Everyone is asking."
"On it."
I take the stairs to the second floor without much hope. Diana and Tom haven't used this floor for a year. The door to the first bedroom, the one where I'd set up the cot for Edie, is closed, so I creep past. I peer into the next room where Harriet and Archie are spread out on the bed watching the screen, their eyes and mouths wide open. The door to the next bedroom, Tom and Diana's old bedroom, is closed too. I hesitate in front of it, then tap lightly.
"Diana?"
When there's no response, I walk inside. I haven't been inside this room before, and it is, quite frankly, ridiculous. There's a hallway, a sitting room, the actual bedroom, though Tom and Diana have been sleeping downstairs for over a year now, and a bathroom the size of our old worker's cottage. Finally, behind the last door is a walk-in closet that would make Carrie Bradshaw weep, complete with shaker cabinetry and a ladder on a pulley that could slide from wall to wall. An ottoman is in the center of the room, and Diana is sitting on it, her head in her hands.
"Diana?"
She looks up. She's crying, but her face has not swelled or become red. No eye makeup has smudged. Diana even cries with composure.
"Are you all right?"
There's something about her like this, so totally vulnerable. She gives me a pathetic excuse for a shrug, as if her shoulders were ultimately too heavy to lift. Then she sighs.
"There's only so many times you can say the same thing. Yes, it was a lovely service. Yes, the sun is beautiful. Yes, Tom would have loved this. I'd reached my quota, so I came in here to hide."
I nod. She looks around the space.
"It's nonsensical, all of this, isn't it? This room was Tom's idea, obviously. I barely have enough clothes to fill that cabinet."
She points to one of the dozen cabinets in the space.
"Tom was always so excessive. More is more. It's bizarre that I didn't hate him, isn't it?"
She laughs, not waiting for me to respond.
"I should probably move to a smaller place now. It makes no sense, me staying here alone. But now that he's gone, I'm not sure I can leave. He's part of this house. I feel him here."
"I feel him here too," I say. Diana looks at me properly. Her lips press together, and for an excruciating moment I think she's going to lose it. Her lips bend at the edges, her chin puckers. But then, at the 11th hour, she regains control.
"Everyone is looking for me, I suppose," she says in a freakishly normal voice.
Is that why you came up here to get me?
She doesn't move yet, but I can see she's readying herself. She'll wipe her face and straighten her blouse, and she'll go down there and do what she needs to. That, after all, is what Diana does. But she shouldn't have to. Not today. And so I shake my head.
No one's even noticed you weren't there, I say. Everything is under control. You stay up here for as long as you need.
I spend the afternoon talking to people I've never met, taking donations for the MND foundations. Diana had requested people make donations in lieu of flowers, and while I don't think she'd meant in cash, I end up with an envelope stuffed with enormous amounts of cash. I make a mental note to figure out how to donate it later. I sign for the caterer and open the back gates when it's time for them to leave, and then I stand at the drinks area and act as a barmaid myself. Patrick and Nettie have had far too much to drink, and when Nettie comes back for another wine, I make her a cup of tea instead, though I doubt she'll drink it. By 7 p.m. the kids are all asleep upstairs. By 8 p.m. people are hungry again, and I order pizzas. Diana is still in the walk-in closet as far as I know. I've told everyone that she's not feeling well and headed off to bed early, and while I hoped people would take this as a hint to leave, they don't seem to be getting it. At 10 p.m. I make a tray of sandwiches and send them around. Nettie is flat-out drunk, and Patrick is in a similar state. Ollie is comparatively sober, and once Pete and the rest of his cousins leave, he comes to give me a hand with Nettie.
Have a sandwich, Nettie, I tell her. And shall I make you another cup of tea?
She shakes her head sullenly.
I want wine.
I think you've had enough, Nets, Ollie says. Anyway, we're all out of wine.
Trust Mum to cheap out on drinks at her own husband's funeral, she slurs.
I try again to give her a sandwich, roast beef and horseradish, but she pushes it away.
She's not even down here talking to people. You'd think she'd be a little more respectful of Dad's memory. She'll sell the house next, just you wait. Then it will be like Dad was never here.
I don't think she will, I try.
She will, Nettie says. I know my mother. She'll probably leave her entire estate to the lost dog's home.
I walk away from them toward the kitchen. I need to unload the dishwasher, and Nettie is in no state to talk anyway. I think of Diana up there in that huge room. I wonder if she's moved since I left her. I make her a plate of sandwiches and a cup of tea, and then I head up to her room, let myself in. She's in the bed now, but her eyes are open. She stares at the wall.
Most people have left, I say, resting the plate and mug on her side table. Patrick and Nettie are still here, but I'll order them an Uber. The house is tidy, more or less, but I'll come back and help you vacuum and mop tomorrow.
Diana stares at me, through me.
There's a sandwich and a cup of tea here, in case you feel like it.
I wait, but she doesn't respond. So I turn and walk back down the hallway. I'm just letting myself out when I hear the faint words.
Thank you, dear.
Chapter 43. Diana. The Past.
It was Tom who insisted that Ollie never know he wasn't his father. Initially, I'd disagreed with him, but Tom had been adamant.
I don't think we should lie to him, Tom. You shouldn't lie to children. People always say that, but why should it be a blanket rule? Surely it should be more of a risk-benefit analysis. By not telling Ollie, we'd be risking him finding out later and blaming us for his missing out on a relationship with his biological father, who, may I add, never wanted him to exist in the first place. But what about the benefits of not telling him? Ollie would believe he was born into a family with two parents that loved each other and wanted him. He'd believe he had a full biological sister. He'd have all that well-adjustedness that children from two-parent families have. Why should we deny him that just so he can't blame us later?
After all, what are parents for if not to blame for your life's troubles?
Tom had been so immovable that ultimately I'd gone along with his wishes. His logic may not have added up, but if he was willing to carry the secret to his deathbed for the sake of my son's adjustment, I didn't see how I was in a position to argue. It was the decision a father would make, I figured. So I let him make it. Tom's not here. I've spent so long trying not to be weak that I'd forgotten how wonderful it feels. For as long as I could remember, I've had to be strong for my family. And being strong has its payoffs. It makes you feel powerful, like you can face anything and survive. It's the reason I've lived my life the way I have, working hard, not wallowing, not accepting weakness. But power is overrated, and being weak and wallowing is surprisingly lovely. Tom's not here. I lie on the downstairs sofa and stare into the unlit fireplace. The cleaner comes and clears it out on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and today is a Wednesday, which is a relief. I might cancel the cleaner. I can clean the house myself.
Don't be ridiculous, Tom says in my mind.
But it's not ridiculous. I'd always found the cleaners to be more of a hindrance than a help, to be honest. To me, cleaner day always meant a furious whip around to ensure I wouldn't be deemed a pig, followed by a need to make myself scarce because being home, twiddling my thumbs, while some invariably foreign girl worked up a sweat scrubbing unspeakable things from my husband's ensuite toilet was just too awful to bear. Tom didn't share my worries about cleaners. If he was home, he'd have languished on the couch, newspaper and coffee in hand. Once I recall watching him lift one foot, then the other, as the girl vacuumed under his boots. He winked at her, and she chuckled. Only Tom could get away with that. Tom's not here. I'm not lonely. There are people I could call to keep me company. Ollie would come, I know that. He'd leave the office in a heartbeat and come straight over, delighting in the opportunity to do a good deed for his old mum. This is probably the reason his business is failing. His priorities are out of whack. He needs to stay at work and make a living to support his wife and family. Nettie might come if I asked, unless she was doing something related to making a baby. My position in her food chain is high, but not highest, which is exactly as it should be. Besides, I have the feeling she has her own issues. Since the sighting of Patrick in Dalesford, I've heard more whispers. Someone spotted him in Bright, someone else in Albury. Patrick, as it turns out, is a busy man. Once I'd have confronted him, asked him what he had to say for himself. Now I can barely find the will to get out of bed. I could call Kathy or Liz or Jan. They've all been calling and texting, offering to drop off meals or take me out. Liz did manage to convince me to come to the Baths for drinks a couple of days ago, but I still haven't quite recovered. The normality of it was simply too much, and I am not ready for normal yet. Tom is dead. I don't care about your daughter-in-law or your fight with your husband or the funny story about your bladder control issues in the dog park. I don't care about any of it. Because Tom's not here. I miss the feel of him. Even a week ago, when Tom was barely alive, I could still reach out and touch him. He was always physically warm, as well as the other type. His warmth was his superpower. People wanted him to lead them. Friends wanted to be around him. Our children loved him best. I loved him best. Mothers aren't supposed to say that, but it's the truth. I was born to love Tom Goodwin. The doorbell rings. I ignore it. This couch feels like a life raft. The outside world is shark-infested waters. I grab the throw rug and pull it around my shoulders, hoping that sleep comes and carries me through until evening, when I can finally change into my pajamas and slide into the comforting blackness of evening. I might have some toast and a cup of tea,
and put something on the television to take the edge off the silence as I rattle about in this big old place. Sometimes at night, I pretend that Tom is still here. I pretend that I'm up and about, ready to stretch out another cramp or give him another sip of water. Those moments we shared in the wee hours of the morning feel so unimaginably luxurious now, those stolen moments, both of us against the world. "I'll be right there, my love," I whisper into the empty house. "You'll feel better in a moment." The doorbell rings again. "You get it, Tom," I whisper, and close my eyes. Chapter 44. Lucy. The present. It's dark when I hear the key in the lock. Nettie and Patrick have left, the kids are asleep, and I'm on the couch, listening to nothing, staring at nothing. "Ollie, is that you?" I hear keys drop into the bowl, and then he appears in the living room. He flops onto the sofa, rests his head back onto the cushion, and closes his eyes. "What happened?" I ask. He keeps his eyes closed.
"They questioned me."
"About what?"
"Everything."
"Ollie."
He opens his eyes. "Honestly, they questioned me about everything. What I was doing the day Mum died, my relationship with her. They asked about my relationship with Nettie, my relationship with you, my business."
I frown. "Your business? Why do they care about that?"
"Well, clearly they knew things weren't going so well. They had all our profit and loss statements. Debt is a pretty big motivation to kill someone."
"But you didn't profit from her death."
"But I didn't know I wouldn't profit. This is something Jones kindly pointed out."
"She was going to tell you."
He looks over at me. "What?"
"I mean, she must have been. Surely Diana would tell you something like that."
Ollie shrugs. "I honestly have no idea."
A frown touches his forehead.
"I saw Eamon while I was there. He was being questioned too."
"About your mother's death?"
"I guess so, who knows?"
Ollie sinks back against the couch, defeated.
"Lucy, can I ask you something?"
"Yes?"
"Do you think I killed Mum?"
I look at him, every part of him so achingly familiar, at the angles of his face, his devoted brown eyes, the curve of his chest. "No, but I do think you are lying about something, and I want you to tell me what it is." Chapter 45. Lucy. The past. I've never been one to believe in fate or having a feeling, but as I drive along Beach Road, I have a sudden urge to call in on Diana. In fact, I make the decision so quickly I nearly take out a cyclist on the inside lane and end up waving profusely as he shakes his fist at me. "Sorry," I mouth, and he gives me the finger. I turn into Diana's driveway. She won't like me turning up unannounced like this, but ever since Tom's funeral I can't seem to get her out of my mind. She must be lonely in this big house all alone. I'd asked Ollie to call her a couple of times, and he had.
"She sounded all right," he'd reported each time. "A bit flat, maybe, but that's to be expected."
And it was to be expected. That didn't mean she couldn't use a friend, if that was even what I was. I press the doorbell. When there's no movement inside, I try the door and find it open. "Hello?" I call out. "Diana? It's Lucy." I find her in the den, horizontal on the couch. "Diana?" I say, but she doesn't so much as lift her head from the pillow. And that's when I realize something is very, very wrong. Diana stares out the passenger window of my car, trance-like. She's wearing her normal uniform, navy slacks, white blouse, pearls, but her clothes look rumpled, like she wore them yesterday and left them on the floor before putting them on again.
She's also wearing black sneakers instead of nude pumps or ballet flats, and her hair is flat on one side, presumably the side she slept on, and she hasn't bothered to fluff it up. She hasn't said a word since she got in, not even to comment on the biscuit crumbs that I wiped off the seat before she sat down.
"Are you okay, Diana?" I ask when we stop at the traffic light.
She's staring at the beach side of the road, at the kite surfers zipping along the horizon at Brighton Beach, but I get the feeling she isn't seeing any of it.
"I'm fine," she says, when enough time has passed that I'm about to repeat myself. I'd offered to call Ollie.
No, he'll be too busy at work.
And Nettie, all she's worried about lately is babies. But it appears she's happy enough for me to be around. She says she's not ill, but she's clearly not well. And so I'm taking her to see her family doctor, Dr. Paisley. But when I pull into the parking lot, Diana still doesn't move.
"All right," I say in a faux jovial voice that makes me cringe at myself.
"Here we are."
Finally, she moves, but slowly, like a much older woman. She goes straight to the waiting room and sits down, leaving me to report to the desk. This is not the Diana I know. She's been sad since Tom died, but today she seems almost childlike. She's much easier to deal with this way, admittedly. But I don't want to deal with her. It's a shock seeing someone so in control become so helpless. I report to the desk and then I sit beside her and wait. Diana takes the magazine I offer her, but doesn't open it. I don't open mine either. When her name is called a few minutes later, I turn to her.
"Would you like me to come in with you?"
She shrugs, which I take as a yes.
Dr. Paisley appears to be in her mid-50s, plump and smiley, dressed in a brightly coloured caftan. Apparently Diana has been seeing her for years.
"Hello," she says, sitting at her desk. She swivels her seat